Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We're launching our new show today. You can hear it every week at this time. The show's title gives you an idea of what it's about, reporting from around Illinois and about Illinois. Today we'll give you an update on efforts to repair Ronald Reagan's boyhood home. We'll look back at the turbulent Democratic National Convention in 1968 and hear from an eyewitness.
It was absolutely a city under attack. I can't imagine ever seeing another disruptive scene, more chaotic. It was unbelievable.
We'll learn more about a game called Assassins. It's played by many high schoolers. It's not a video game, but in a time that we're seeing more school shootings, is it appropriate? Then the Illinois State Fair will be getting underway next week in Springfield. We'll hear from the man who's taken on the role of private fundraiser for needed repairs at the fairgrounds. That and more ahead this hour. Stay with us for Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's our first show, and we're focusing on stories from in and around Illinois, and we have reporters based across the state from top to bottom. You'll hear from some of them each week. Still ahead today, we'll highlight a program to help educate kids in the state's juvenile justice system. And we look back at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago and the chaos that surrounded it. It's all coming up on Statewide. I'm glad you could join us. Let's get started this week. At Springfield High School, Ethan Doyle is an honor student, a member of the baseball team, the investment club, and an elite student group known as the Superintendent's Roundtable. But perhaps his most notable accomplishment came during the spring of his sophomore year when he assassinated more of his classmates than anyone else. Dusty Rhodes explains.
How proud were your parents when you went assassins last year?
My mom didn't really care, but my dad was, he was hyped up about it a little bit. He was excited.
Excited because Ethan had triumphed in a game that has been played in this town, and as I discovered many others, for generations, which means some of you listening out there already know all about assassins. For those who don't, well, I'm going to let this guy explain.
My name's Dan Ryan, Leland Grove Police Department, the chief of police. The game of assassin is where it's normally put on in the spring. Normally what we deal with is high school kids. You're assigned a certain person. You say you have to go get that person, and they don't know who their targets are, or the targets don't know who the assassin is. And so it's a game of basically like the last man standing. And it's played with water guns.
At least that's the version Chief Ryan played when he was in high school. There are many variations. I found the game being played across the country, everywhere from summer camps to Bible colleges, with weapons ranging from Nerf guns to silly string to magic wands to magic markers. Remember the TV show Gossip Girl? One episode was devoted to a game of assassins played using Polaroid pictures. At MIT, where the game has been played since at least the 1980s, there's even an Assassin's Guild that hosts exquisitely complex permutations of the game.
The version at MIT is usually played with little rubber darts with little suction cups at the end. They don't go very far, they don't do any damage, and they're obviously not real guns.
That's Philip Tan. He runs MIT's Game Lab, which is part of the Humanities Department.
They're all getting to know you games. They're all games where you get the name of somebody that you may not know, and then you have to like figure out who they are, where they are, you know, stick them up with a banana or something like that and then say bang. But really, it's not all that different from a Secret Santa. It's just the way you make that connection. It's not giving someone a gift. It's giving someone a dart.
But for some people, a game that ends with a gift doesn't belong in the same category as a game that ends with a dart. And nowadays, the notion of students stalking each other, even with squirt guns, can be upsetting. In February, when a 19-year-old male shot and killed 17 people at a Florida high school, a mom watching the news in suburban Hinsdale, Illinois, contacted her local high school's principal to say that, as a show of respect, the game should be suspended. Her request was reported in the Chicago Tribune, which withheld her name. The issue became so toxic in Hinsdale, I couldn't find anyone willing to talk to me about assassins. But since the game was never played on school property, Hinsdale officials couldn't stop it, and the students opted to carry on their tradition.
Well, yeah, in the age of school massacres, it becomes much more complicated, doesn't it?
Kurt Squire is a game creator and professor at the University of California, Irvine.
So, on the one hand, it just seems to be in bad taste to be joking and talking about these things. But on the other hand, we do know that one of the ways that people deal with such stresses is to play them out. And there can be, for some people, a feeling of taking ownership or being empowered over these themes by playing them out and kind of showing that you're not going to be afraid of them or you're not going to be paralyzed by them.
This issue hit close to home for me. A student at Springfield High School lost a brother to violence just a few months before Assassins began in April, yet that student signed up to play. And who fired the fatal blast of H2O to knock him out of the game? My own 17-year-old son, Evan.
He's doing it to have fun, to get things off his mind, trying to live his life the best he could. I think that's what his brother would want him to do. So, yeah.
That's a great theory, and I hope he's right. At my request, Evan texted his classmate to see if he wanted to speak for himself, and his response was, "Nah, I'm not feeling it." For Illinois Newsroom, I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment. Now let's turn to a different game. Lacrosse is a Native American game that dates back to the 1630s. It came into its present form on the East Coast, and it slowly made its way to the Midwest. Small colleges, like Illinois Wesleyan University, are using it to stay competitive in recruiting students. Now even high schools are picking it up, as Brian Bloodworth reports.
That's not the sound of Illinois Wesleyan's football team taking the field. It's the Titans men's lacrosse team before a recent game. Men's team coach Zach Iannucci says IWU was not an early adopter or a late comer.
We were kind of in the middle of when the school started. We're in our fifth year, so we were a little bit later. It's really grown fast.
Lacrosse is a team sport played with a hollowed metal stick that varies in length with a butterfly net type glove on the end. The players use the stick to carry, pass, catch, control, and shoot the 2-ounce soft rubber lacrosse ball into the opposing team's goal. Iannucci says each goal is worth 1 point.
I guess you'd call it like a mix of many sports. So you got hockey in there, you've got some football, some soccer. It's fast, it's physical, it's a lot of fun to play, a lot of fun to watch. Hockey's probably the closest that if someone doesn't know the sport.
The games last an hour. Will Harris is a freshman goalie for the Titans.
It's called the fastest sport on 2 feet for a reason, and it's fast-paced, lots of goals, lots of excitement.
Harris began playing the sport in third grade. He says the speed of the game makes it fun.
There's so many parts of it that are fun, but being a goalie, kind of last line of defense, is something that I've always got like an adrenaline rush from it. But playing goalie, I mean, you got to have some kind of crazy to step in cage. Brutal position. Bruised and battered all over, from taking shots off the knee, taking shots off the thigh, arms, all over the place. Labor of love.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
Senior midfielder Nick Winter says the 110-yard, 65-foot men's field basically has three sections.
Offensive end, you have three attackmen that have to stay on the offensive end. Then you have three midfielders who can run the length of the field, and then you have defenders who have to stay on their defensive ends.
Players wear shoulder and elbow pads, gloves, and helmets. Coach Iannucci says it gets physical.
It's more of a contact sport, not a collision sport. Like, football is very much a collision sport. There is contact. Like, you can hit each other with your stick. You see some big hits sometimes, but, like, a couple in a game, not like football where it's every play. It's a much safer, just because it's not the goal of each play to take somebody to the ground.
Let's go, Jay!
Oh yeah, Jay! Oh yeah, Jay!
Full contact is a feature of the men's game, but not so much in the women's game. Lindsay Keller coaches the women for Wesleyan.
Your stick can't touch their body, but you can put contact on from a defensive positioning point of view with your body and their body. So it's kind of similar, I would say, to the contact that you may see in basketball.
Keller says there are other differences in the women's game. For one, the field is 120 yards long, there is a 90-second possession clock, and 12 players are on the field rather than 10.
I don't know where the differences started at. With the Native Americans starting the sport, they were all men. Only males played it. In Scotland is where they started kind of the women's side, and so I think the games have been very different.
Keller, like Iannucci, grew up and played lacrosse in college on the East Coast.
Zach equated men's lacrosse more to hockey, where it's a little bit quicker like that. Women's lacrosse is growing to be quicker. We've actually just introduced a possession clock, which has sped the game up a little bit. It's faster than soccer, but it's not quite as fast as men's lacrosse.
Players from across the country sprinkle the men's and women's rosters, but Iannucci says the majority hail from the Chicago suburbs.
And the sport has grown, and the level of player has really grown as well, and that's been really helpful for us as we've continued to grow our program.
Keller says the girls' game is growing as well.
The one thing that we compete with in the state of Illinois is that soccer is in the same season, whereas in other states it's not. You know, if that ever changes, that would be really nice, and I think we'd get more interest from the girls' side.
Matt Troha of the Illinois High School Association says the IHSA added it to the state tournament series this year.
When we looked at the youth numbers that U.S. lacrosse gave us, there's been a several-year span where they're just doubling year over year, especially in Illinois and the Midwest. So we just kind of looked at that and said, hey, the numbers are here. These kids are playing, and they're going to be in high school soon. And, you know, to provide them that participation opportunity is something we wanted to do.
In this year's state tournament series, 78 boys and 58 girls teams played for championships. The only downstate schools are Dunlap on the boys' side and O'Fallon on the girls' side. Troha says the IHSA expects more teams next year.
We're excited about the growth. The Peoria area looks like it could have as many as 3 to 4 teams as early as next year. You know, we anticipate Bloomington, Normal area should have a team. You know, we think the Quad Cities will, Springfield, Champaign did in the past, and we expect that to come back.
How soon does Troha see a team from Bloomington Normal in the state series?
I would hope in maybe 3 years, probably 5 maybe is a safe estimate. But I would be really surprised if they're not a high school team there within 5 years.
Both Iannucci and Keller say the games are appealing.
You'll love it if you watch it. You might not have any idea what's going on at first, but I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's a really lot of fun.
Again, like in hockey, you may not know all the rules or why they're doing certain things, but it catches on and it's fast moving and it's exciting, which I think is probably the best part, is that it's a faster sport.
I'm Brian Bloodworth.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
You're listening to Statewide. Now let's check in on Ronald Reagan's first boyhood home in Dixon. A couple of years ago, the Washington Post said it was falling apart. Today, things are looking much better. But the museum there says more work still needs to be done. Guy Stevens has more.
Volunteer Cheryl Yard gives me a tour of the two-story 19th century frame house on Hennepin Avenue that the Reagans lived in from 1920 to 1923. A foundation was set up to restore and manage the house soon after Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. Yard says they went to great lengths to make it as close as possible to how it was when Jack Reagan, his wife Nell, and their boys Neil and Ronald lived there. She points to the wallpaper. Like in a lot of old houses, there were many layers.
They took the paper off, sent it to President Reagan and his brother, and said, which layer did you have? And they replicated that. I think it's pretty impressive myself.
The furnishings had been lost in a fire, and the big cast iron tub in the small upstairs bathroom was the only original piece that remained. But again, with the help of the Reagan brothers, the home was recreated with period furnishings that match what was there at the time. Yard says there's one feature in the sitting room that everyone, especially kids, enjoy hearing about, a loose tile in front of the fireplace that Reagan insisted be kept that way during the restoration. The reason why was revealed when the president and his brother Neil came to the dedication in 1984.
He found the tile, and he says, Neil, give me some pennies. So Neil gives him some pennies, and he puts them down there. He says, what are you doing? He says, this is where I used to hide my money from you.
The original tile is now in the Reagan Library and Museum in California, but a copy keeps the story alive in Dixon. Reagan Home Executive Director Patrick Gorman says a steady stream of visitors have come since its opening, last year from every state and 27 countries. But, Gorman says, over the decades, the money dwindled and supporters moved or passed away. Time took its inevitable toll on the home, the old house next door that serves as a visitor center, and the rest of the small campus. So when Washington Post writer Roxanne Roberts wrote an article in October 2016 that began, Ronald Reagan's house is falling apart, she wasn't far off the mark. Gorman says he was shocked at the museum's state of disrepair when he took the director's job that year and set out to change that.
We put a roof on the visitor center, we sited it, new storm windows, we painted the home, got new storm windows for the home, tuck point of the basement, you name it, and we've done it.
There was no money for all the work, Gorman says, but repairs couldn't wait.
We went to the local bank and we took out a line of credit. That's what we had to do. And we are in the process of paying it back. Board of Directors is working on fundraising at this time, and I have all the confidence in the world in my new board.
Even the grass is new, looking lush and well cared for thanks to a dedicated volunteer. The visitors' bathrooms have been remodeled, and repairs continue on window frames and other parts of the old structures. But there's always more to be done. A lifelong resident of Dixon, Gorman says this job is part of his commitment to helping his hometown. But there's also a personal connection.
My parents owned the second Ronald Reagan home in Dixon, so I grew up you know, hearing about Ronald Reagan long before he was president, the actor, and it was kind of a big deal in my parents' eyes that, you know, they owned the second home.
And though most visitors won't know it, there's evidence of that connection in the Reagan home, sitting on the fireplace mantel, an old photograph of the future president that Gorman found in the museum's collection.
That's my mom and dad's house. That's in the front yard. That's special to me.
It doesn't really belong here, he says, but he thinks 2 years of 50-hour weeks spent restoring the site ought to entitle him to something. And it is a picture of Reagan as a boy in Dixon, after all. Perks, personal connections, and civic pride aside, Gorman says it's important to keep a place like this up. That's what people expect, and should expect to see.
If I went to a presidential home, Grant's, for example, or Herbert Hoover, and I've been to both of them, they look very dignified and very professional, and that's what I was striving to achieve here, and I think we're nearly there. We're nearly there.
After all, he says, it's not about politics, it's about history, and a place that the only U.S. president born in Illinois called home. I'm Guy Stevens.
Ronald Reagan was from Illinois, but this is still the land of Lincoln. A famous image of the great emancipator will be displayed in courthouses throughout the state. Rich Egger has more from Macomb.
A high-quality reproduction of a photo of Abraham Lincoln was unveiled during a brief ceremony at the courthouse. The photo was taken in Springfield in 1860, right after Lincoln won the Republican nomination for president. The reproduction is a donation from the Illinois Judges Association, the Illinois State Bar Association, and their foundations. The groups are giving the same gift to every courthouse in the state to celebrate Illinois' bicentennial. John Cody is immediate past president of the Judges Association. He says the photo of Lincoln serves as a visual reminder that America is supposed to be guided by principles.
Law in our state and our country is not just supposed to be the opinions of the people who administer the law, the feelings of the judges. Instead, we're to be guided by the Constitution and statutes and precedent. So he stood for that, as well as standing for integrity and honesty.
The framed reproduction is large. It's 30 inches wide, 40 inches tall. Rich Egger reporting.
Stay with us. There's more to come. We'll look back on the 1968 Democratic National Convention that took place in Chicago. That's just ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 50 years ago this month, Democrats gathered in Chicago for their convention. They nominated Hubert Humphrey as their presidential candidate, but also showing up thousands of protesters voicing opposition to the Vietnam War. And of course, it resulted in chaos on the streets, even on the convention floor. And the whole world was watching.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walter, as you can see...
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan. We're obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall.
Today, we're looking back at that event, which took place at the International Amphitheater. Joining me is Mark Depew. He's director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library's Oral History Program. Also, author Taylor Pinsoneau, who was sent to the convention when he was a political reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks, Sean.
Glad to be here, Sean.
Taylor, let me start with you. What were you expecting when you went? I know word was out that there were going to be some major demonstrations. Were you have a little bit of trepidation going into that?
A little bit, Sean. But of course, I never anticipated what occurred. I had no idea, and I don't think many other individuals tied to the convention had any idea what would occur, what would develop before it was over. Frankly, I like to say that before it was over, I was a witness to what Norman Mailer, the author Norman Mailer, called the Siege of Chicago. It was absolutely a city under attack. Its functioning was disrupted. I have never, can't imagine ever seeing another disruptive scene, more chaotic. It was, in many aspects, it was unbelievable. And I got up there a few days earlier to write some political stories. But, of course, as you already said, rumors were swirling that the protesters were going to be out in force. They were already coming in droves. And the expectations were that there was going to be extreme activity, to put it mildly, on the streets of Chicago, and that certainly enveloped. In my case, I've got the experience, fortunately or unfortunately, most aspects of it. I covered the actual convention itself down in the International Amphitheater, but I also spent time with some of the protesters or on the edge of Grand Park, and the Post-Dispatch had leased space in the bottom, our basement of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. That's where we wrote our stories, and the Conrad Hilton Hotel, of course, was the headquarters for McCarthy, and it was absolutely crammed with protesters and other individuals. You couldn't turn around, and I was in one way or another involved in frankly in all of it.
You were still a relatively young reporter at the time.
I was. I tried to figure it out, and I was going to tell Mark that. I think I was 27 years old at the time.
Well, you know, I think as reporters, often you're witness to history, but you don't know it as much. You don't realize what the impact's going to be long term. Did you realize that then, that this was going to be something that was really, really going to stand out in history and politics?
I did, Sean. Yeah, I recognize that I was part of a journalistic part of something that would be an irrevocable memory for the rest of my life, and for something that I realized the whole world was watching. In fact, in one of the protests, I think it was Wednesday night, thousands of protesters were shouting in unison, "Remember, the whole world is watching." So I would say yes. I accurately felt that this was something that would never be forgotten in modern American political history. Could not be erased.
One of those people who was watching, Mark, that was you. At the time, I'm not sure how old you were back then, but you were paying attention to what was going on.
I was 14 years old, and like a lot of people, I was watching it all on TV. I remember, the whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. And I'd already gotten really interested in American politics, and I certainly was paying attention to that.
As part of the oral history program here in with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, you've talked to a lot of people who were involved in politics. That moment stands out in the state's history, doesn't it?
It sure does. In fact, I've got a pretty standard list of questions I ask when I get to 1968, because it was such a pivotal and important year in American history. Of course, as you and your listeners will recall, it starts with the Tet Offensive at the end of January, and that pretty much changed people's perception of the Vietnam War. Then you've got Johnson's decision to drop out of the race, and on April 4th of that year is the day that the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and of course, cities across the country exploded in violence after that. Then in June, you've got Robert Kennedy's assassination. There were things going on internationally. There were the Columbia University sit-in. The students had taken over the university campus. It was a crazy year, but you know, nothing was as crazy as what happened at the Democratic Convention.
And there was a lot of activity going on outside, as we've talked about, but it seems to me it was just as wild on the convention floor. Things that I've seen, archive video of that, people, delegates being hauled out of the convention center. I mean, it was pretty crazy, wasn't it?
Well, I can simply say that some of the states had rival delegations that came to Chicago, and there were all sorts of controversies over what delegations would be seated and which ones would be rebuffed. And there were divisions on the convention floor. It seemed like in many of the positions, there were many sympathizers with the protesters, especially among the New York and California delegates. I remember that. And then you had more conservative delegations from obviously states like, you know, Alabama, Georgia, and so on. There were fisticuffs on the convention floor. Sometimes there was outright disorder, which is not all that unusual at a national convention, but it was much more aggravated, I thought, and much more tense from the opening bell at the amphitheater where the convention was held.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six policemen came in here, some of them wearing the blue helmets of the Chicago Police Force, and they are dragging out of here the people who were involved in this. One delegate from New York who objected to having his credentials checked.
This surely is the first time that policemen have ever entered a convention, a floor of a convention.
In the United States.
Colorado. Mr. Chairman, Colorado rises to a point of information. Is there any rule under which Mayor Daley can be compelled to suspend the police state terror perpetrated this minute on kids in front of the Conrad Hilton?
As I look at the confusion in this hall and watch on television the turmoil and violence that is competing with this great convention for the attention of the American people, and with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have a National Guard.
That sound from the floor of the convention and also outside. You heard Abe Ribicoff there making the announcement of the Gestapo tactics, as he termed them. Former Mayor Daley, the older Mayor Daley, he took offense to that, of course, gesturing at the time after that line was delivered. It seemed like the party was coming apart at the seams. Did it feel that way to you at the time?
Well, it definitely did. The divisions were very steep, and there was great hostility within the party. But back to the Daley Ribicoff thing, that's one of the episodes or anecdotes I like to relate. I was on the floor at that time interviewing the Illinois delegates, which were essentially the Chicago Democratic delegates. I was kneeling down. Reporters like me were allowed to go out for like 10-minute periods, and then you had to come back to the sidelines. That was during one of my 10-minute periods. I was literally kneeling down, talking to a Democratic member of the Daley entourage, Francis Lorenz, and Mayor Daley was seated either right next to Lorenz or no more than two chairs down. And Ribicoff was on the podium, and he was taking off on Daley, the Gestapo tactics and all that. And Daley erupted and started shouting, you know, shut up, you know, cut it out, get off the podium. And then Daley cuffed his hands around his mouth and started to boo. And immediately, all of the Democratic delegates, they were all Daley people, of course, all in unison started to boo along with Daley. Whatever Daley did, they echoed. It was automatic. And it was very dramatic. And I've even seen pictures, elongated pictures, of the line of seats where Daley was seated. And you can see me crouched behind Francis Lorenz's chair. And it's just a very memorable moment. And, of course, that was my lead in the next day's story, and that was the major story in the Post-Dispatch the next morning, obviously.
We are talking with Taylor Pinsoneau, author and a former reporter. We're going back 50 years to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Also talking with Mark DePew, he's director of the Oral History Program at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. Mark, there has been protesting at every convention since. I'm sure there were some protests before that one as well. Why does this one resonate so much?
Well, it was all about the students had a lot of things. The protesters had a lot of things. But the Vietnam War was really the central thing. And Taylor was talking about what was going on at the convention itself. One of the things that really got into a heated debate, and I think it was the second night of the convention, was one of the planks of the platform, which was about a anti-war plank. And it was finally defeated after a very lengthy discussion, and that really fired up the crowds and got them going, because that was what they wanted to see. They wanted Eugene McCarthy to emerge out of this thing, which was not going to happen, and they wanted that peace plank. And you know, the whole nation, because of what had happened earlier in the year and gotten disillusioned about the Vietnam War, and you only see that protest against the war growing after this. But that was really one of the flashpoints.
It didn't reflect well, of course, on the Democratic Party at the time, but Chicago itself, it's always had this image of a rough and tumble city, I guess going back to Al Capone, many others. But the imagery that was delivered right into the country's living rooms, that had a lasting impact as well.
Yeah, it sure did. And as Taylor was reporting as well, one of the aftermaths of that is what has become known as the Walker Report. A future Illinois governor, Dan Walker, was an attorney for Montgomery Ward, was selected to head up that commission. And once the report eventually came out, he declared that this was a police riot.
And Taylor, did you talk with any police officers? Have you talked with some in the past about it and their views?
I talked to police officers at the time, Sean, and their instructions were to brook no disorder. Apparently there had been riots earlier in the year in Chicago surrounding like the death of Martin Luther King Jr. And so on. And at that time, many felt that the official response from law enforcement was not sufficient. And Mayor Daley had given strict orders to brook no property damage, no open hostility. This was supposed to be, you know, Daley was the most prominent political figure in America at the time. And this was to be the apex or the premier moment of his long control of Chicago. This was his baby. He wanted this convention in Chicago, and he had dedicated all of his available resources to make it the most memorable political convention of all time in modern American political history. And, of course, that happened, but it didn't happen the way he wanted. But nevertheless, this convention was Daley's baby, and it's incredible that it turned out the way it did, especially in view of the fact that he had such control over all of the political mechanisms, really not just of Chicago, but of the state in many regards.
And if I can add, Sean, on the other side, the students and the protesters who are coming, people like Abby Hoffman, who was head of a group called the Yippies, Youth International Party, right, Taylor?
Right, Mark.
They had it in their minds, the small minority of the protesters, but they had in their minds they were going to instigate some kind of conflict.
And certainly the TV cameras helped with that.
Right.
So everybody played a part in this whole thing. Before I let you guys go, just to give your thoughts on what the legacy of this convention has been. When you look back at this moment in history, what's been the legacy, whether it's Illinois, whether it's the city of Chicago, whether it's politics in general?
Well, I think that the immediate legacy was that it greatly damaged the Democratic Party. The party was already seriously split leading into the convention, and it was broken as a result of this convention. It left the nominee for president of the convention, Hubert Humphrey. He was vice president at the time, Vice President Humphrey, with, in my opinion, little chance of winning in the general election. He started out in a terrific hole with a terrific monkey on his back in the final months of the campaign because of the Chicago Convention. And I think the legacy is that it put the Democrats on the back burner nationally, and they did not make a comeback until the second term of Richard Nixon's presidency, when Watergate took over the scene, and that allowed the Democrats to come into play big time again in our national political picture.
Yeah, and it's no surprise that what did Richard Nixon run on? Law and order. Law and order. And anybody who was watching what was going on in America with the riots after Martin Luther King assassination, but especially this one, as Taylor hinted at, you know, they were seeing these crazy kids in Chicago flying the Viet Cong flag, dragging down the American flag, climbing up on statues. I don't know that they saw many things like the protesters throwing urine and feces and calling the police officers pigs over and over and over again. But I think from a historical perspective, that part of it has been downplayed.
That's Mark DePew. He's the director of the Oral History Project at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, and also Taylor Pinsano. Taylor was at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago 50 years ago.
Chicago, for the help that we can bring, we can change the world.
You're listening to Statewide. Back with more in a moment. I'm Sean Crawford, and this is Statewide. A lot of repairs and renovations are needed at the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield, and the price tag is steep. How's a fundraising effort going? We'll find out in a few moments. But first, a pioneering juvenile justice program in Illinois blends online and classroom instruction. Illinois Issues partnered with the national education newsletter, The Hechinger Report, to learn more. Maureen McKinney talked with the author of the story, reporter Tara Garcia Mathewson.
Illinois, for the last few years now, has incorporated a blended learning model in their juvenile justice facilities. And so students are able to do work online. And so they can do self-paced study of classes that they need to really accumulate the credit toward their own graduation.
Tell me more about the blended learning program that Illinois is using and why it's done that.
This was actually prompted by a lawsuit. In 2012, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, arguing that the education opportunities, among other things, were not meeting legal basic requirements. The Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, from the beginning, was a partner on finding a solution for this, and blended learning was one of the ways the department and also the ACLU were advocating would improve educational opportunity for students. The superintendent of the school district, Sophia Jones Redmond, the way she is really pushing the different facilities to do it is have a blended learning system where most days students spend most of their time working on courses that they choose and that they need and kind of self-paced instruction on the computer. But when they have a no computer day, that day is really dedicated to more traditional instruction and more interaction among students in the class and then students and teachers. But along the way, as students are working on their work at their computers, the idea is that they would have teachers there who can also help support them and answer questions along the way.
And how does it seem to be working?
It definitely varies. So Illinois has a number of juvenile justice facilities, and each one has differences based on the population of juveniles that are in the facilities on any given day. So there's one, Pere Marquette, that has, you know, maybe 25 students per day is their average. And so they have much smaller student-teacher ratios, and it's also a minimum security facility. The principal there, Cynthia Houston, described a pretty high-functioning blended learning model where students really do get a combination of online time and face-to-face time with teachers. But in St. Charles, which is a higher security facility that has many more kids every day, there's a lot of other things happening in the facility that get in the way of education. You know, last summer, the majority of the school days, school was canceled because of something else happening, whether it was a security concern or it's a mixed bag for sure.
What are some of the challenges to improving education in juvenile justice?
I think the real major challenge is a question of priorities. So many people probably in the juvenile justice system would consider safety and security to be the top priority, not education. And so, of course, with young people that are K through 12 school-aged, education is a priority for others. And part of the problem with this population is there are just not a lot of people fighting for that access. There's not a lot of kind of resounding commitment to improving educational opportunities and educational quality in juvenile justice facilities. So there have been lawsuits in more than half of the states over the last 30 years that are pushing for greater educational quality in juvenile justice facilities. And part of this is based on research that shows how important educational attainment can be once kids come out. But it's a combination of, you know, the idea that there aren't people necessarily to fight for this, that it's a system that's kind of behind closed doors. So even the parents of these students, they're not really seeing what's happening in there. The students themselves are not the most empowered group that are fighting for their own opportunities, even though the lawsuit in Illinois did come from complaints, and it really stemmed from complaints that the young people were filing, saying that they wanted more opportunities and more time in classrooms. So there's a lot of challenges. And of course, going back to the idea that you have this group of kids that are all at different grade levels and capacity levels and places in their educational journey all in one room, that's all just very difficult.
That's reporter Tara Garcia Mathewson. She works for the national education newsletter, The Hechinger Report, which partnered with Illinois Issues this week on juvenile justice education. It's that time of the year, the Illinois State Fair, just under a week away, and for the second year in a row, the Coliseum on the grounds will remain closed, but fairgoers will notice some minor improvements, like repaved roads and some new LED lighting. The Illinois Fairgrounds Foundation was created 2 years ago as an effort to raise money for the many necessary repairs to many of the buildings on the grounds. Our reporter Jacqueline Driscoll sat down with the president of the foundation, John Slayton, to check in on the progress of the organization.
Governor Rauner announced the Fairgrounds Foundation back in August of 2016. You did receive your tax-exempt status in July of 2017. So how are things going?
Things have picked up, but yet not at the pace that we had hoped for. There has been some successes and some failures. We talked for 16 months with a large agricultural entity here in the state of Illinois, and I went to a board meeting of their board of directors and made a presentation, and a week later they turned it down, and that was for naming rights on a prominent building on the fairgrounds. We have a donor in northern Illinois that sends us $2,500 every month, so I give him a lot of thanks for doing that. We've had other donors in the $5,000 to $10,000 range. We have a sponsor on the show ring in the livestock center called the George Obernagel Family Farms show ring, so there will be signage up to reflect that sponsorship. We have a local physician who did naming rights on a horse barn on the back corner of their fairground, so I'm not sure how many people will see that, but it was very generous of him to do a naming of this barn 41, and he named it after a late horse trainer, so that was a very nice gesture. We still continue to pursue donations of any size, but a lot of focus on the larger corporate gifts so we can get some names on some buildings around the fairgrounds.
You mentioned $180 million, correct, was the total that we estimated for all of the renovations. How much have we raised so far?
I stutter when I say that number because it's a big one, but right now we are a little over $100,000. I will never see that to the end, but in comparison, if you look at the Iowa State Fair and their foundation, which is called the Blue Ribbon Foundation, that foundation was established about 25 years ago. It was either last year at their state fair or this year that they're celebrating 25 years. So they have raised over $100 million in 25 years, and that's what we want to be like.
Slowly but surely moving things along.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of companies in Illinois, and a lot of them are agricultural companies like John Deere and ADM and Caterpillar and CME Group and State Farm, and so those are on our target list, and we hope to connect with them here shortly.
And I believe last time we spoke, we talked about some of those bigger donors actually contributing to the Blue Ribbon Foundation for Iowa. I believe John Deere was one of them that made contributions. Have we been successful in bringing them back to Illinois?
Well, John Deere is headquartered in Illinois, so because the Iowa State Fair got such a head start on us, John Deere chose that fairgrounds. And I think, given the opportunity to meet with them, which will probably come through a conversation that Governor Rauner has with their CEO, we'll probably end up with John Deere on this fairgrounds. I feel pretty certain of that.
Probably since the Coliseum was shut down, maybe even before, fairgoers, people of Illinois have recognized that the fairgrounds does have some buildings that are in need of serious work. They're does need to be some renovations on the grounds. When people are coming into the fair this year, what can they expect to see? What changes can they expect to see in terms of renovations?
If you're aware, and I'm sure you are, in June, the legislature approved $30 million for the Department of Agriculture. So the asphalt right here in front of us was part of the $30 million. And this was done with the intent to get something done before the fair, because most of the $30 million will be used post-2018 Illinois State Fair. But you'll see rooftops starting to be stripped. And those rooftops are rooftops that needed replaced 20 or 30 years ago, maybe even 40 years ago. But there are 170 buildings on the Illinois State Fairgrounds, and I would challenge you to find one that doesn't need repairs or renovation, because there's not one here that doesn't.
Do you know what some other big projects are for that $30 million?
The Coliseum's probably number one on the list to get it back up to speed and get it renovated and get all the horse shows back to Springfield, Illinois, where they belong. And I think they're anxious to come back.
We've heard that the Coliseum is top priority, top priority. When does the top priority make any, you know, real headway?
Well, the issue there was structural, and it happened right after Governor Rahner established the foundation. So that would have been November of 2016. It's pretty intricate, complex work that will have to be done to that building, and it starts from the rooftop to the bottom of the support structures inside the Coliseum. That facility is slated to be open for the 2019 Illinois State Fair, so it'll be great to have it back online.
Do you know how much it costs to actually, you know, revamp the Coliseum?
The early estimate is $7 to $8 million, and then if we want to heat it and air condition it, which is a goal of the foundation, that's another $2 to $3 million. But it makes it a year-round venue that way, and I think horse people would appreciate that.
And I believe it was this past spring, there was a horse barn that was in such disarray that it needed immediate repairs. Do you foresee that happening with any of the other buildings?
Well, that was a pretty key building because it was located just west of the Coliseum. It's barn 13, and it took about a $600,000 or $700,000 fix for roofing and structural issues underneath the roof. So it's done and up and looks very nice, and so that one's another we can cross off the list. Other buildings on the fairgrounds that are that close or that bad of shape, I don't think there are any. But again, you look at the 25 series barns, which are across from the Coliseum running to the west. I think there are 16 or 18 of those barns, and every one of them need a roof. They're brick barns that hold horses and cattle during the state fair, and to do a roof on one of those buildings is about $40,000 a piece, so it gets expensive. The dairy barn is probably one of the worst as far as roofs on the fairgrounds. It's got tar paper up there now, and as soon as the fair's over, they'll re-roof it and bring it back to its historic significance.
Have you found it difficult to reach out to these businesses, whether big or small, to make these contributions?
No, and there are a lot of causes out there. If you look at the governor's mansion, was just completed at a cost of about $15 or $16 million, and it was a very worthy cause. So that has been successful, but these companies only have so much money that they can give to certain causes. So we may have to wait our turn a little bit for some of the larger companies that gave money elsewhere.
We know that we have two very wealthy gubernatorial candidates. Have either of them made any personal contributions?
To date, neither of them have. I fully suspect Governor Rahner's in the consideration stage of doing something. People think I'm crazy, but I would like to do it without Governor Rahner, because he's tried to save so many projects here in Springfield. And I know he's a very wealthy individual, but it'd be nice to do it without him having to throw some personal funds at it.
Anything from J.B. Pritzker?
Have not talked to him, have not heard from him. I'm sure he'll be here on Democrat Day, but beyond that, I doubt that our paths cross.
John Slayton is president of the Illinois Fairgrounds Foundation, which is raising money for repairs and upkeep at the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield. The State Fair begins its annual 10-day run starting next week. And we'll be with you again next week at this same time. Glad you could join us for the launch of our new program, Statewide. We'll bring you more stories and conversations from in and around Illinois. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford.